farm, and I was the only male.
I see.
I was the senior male, in fact, the only one finally, handling a herd of dairy cows, which meant morning and night duty no matter what.
So you really found, though, everything at real load, because the normal school year was packed.
It was something that was added to whatever everybody else was doing. And there was the time, the high point of it was when I went to sleep in Dr. McLaurin's lecture. And he never as much as mentioned the fact. He only paused long enough that the silence of the room woke me up.
Oh, dear.
But I've held that to his everlasting credit, because the rest of his staff were like that too, including Denton. And Denton was a bit rough at times. Well, if you're a man's man, that's to be expected, and not resented either.
He was pretty fair to the boys, though. What about everybody, wasn't he?
I thought so. So that the attitude of students was something, if it was atmosphere you're looking for, probably the biggest change has taken place in that sphere. The attitude of the pupils towards others who may not be as well off as themselves. As a matter of fact, for that book, just as an example, you had to bring that book with you. I haven't got one. I couldn't afford one.
How much were they?
35 cents, I think.
Really?
I'm not sure.
Didn't realize that the annuals were for sale. I thought maybe they were given out to the students.
No, we had to pay them. It was a nominal sum, mind you. I don't think they made any profit on it, but I think it was all of... Oh, I don't even know, 35, 50 cents or something, of course. That was real money. Technical aids, of course, were entirely lacking. Such things as overhead projectors and any electronic devices were no part of our stunt at all. We didn't have that advantage, but out of that situation grows an advantage, I think, that the resourcefulness of the teacher in providing visual aids, the skillful use of the blackboard. Here I sound like 50 and 60 years ago, which is correct, that's what it is. That it brought out a resourcefulness in the teacher that might not be supplied. The weakness of any prefabricated device, such as an overhead projector, just to name one, means that you've got to have a lot of preparation in advance. Furthermore, you're supplying them with pictorial material sometimes that's irrelevant to what it is that you're trying to teach, because these plates are prepared. It's something like pulling down a map of Canada in front of a big class. And the map is almost useless because it supplies and is loaded with information that's quite irrelevant to what you're trying to do. But make that map of your own chalk and your own stuff and put on it what you want to emphasize and leave out everything else. You've got yourself visual aid number one, the blackboard, skillfully used. Now, I admit, not all people are skillful along artistic lines, but those who are learn to use a blackboard for its proper use. They get a visual aid that it has been overlooked by most people most of the time.
I was speaking to one woman, and she mentioned this course that you took in normal school, in how to write on a blackboard and the care of a blackboard. And she was saying that the simple things like which proper chalk to use made a world of difference.
Mm-hmm.
And she's found that since, when she's been substituting teaching, after the normal school students have been teaching, or since normal school finished and more education students have come in, they've lost these simple little basics, and it's made a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because you ruin a blackboard by using the wrong chalk sometimes.
Yes. Or certain people seated on a certain part of the classroom looking at that board can get nothing but a light reflection from the windows. And that's a situation. Or the teacher himself walking over to the window and leaning his elbows on the window ledge and talking, not realizing that the students looking at him are looking into a battery of light. And that's very, very tiring on the student, for one thing. It makes them restive. And it's a real hardship if you have to look at a person who is framed as a silhouette more than anything else. He should stay away from the windows.
You were taught these basics, were you, at the normal school?
You bet we were. There was nothing academic about it. In fact, its detractors would have called it basket weaving. You perhaps heard the phrase. But if you are going to weave baskets, then you better learn how. And it's not just because of the glow of 50 or 60 years having gone by, or however many it is since 1925. It's not only because of that, because I would have said that at the time, but time has proved it. What we got at the normal school was practical, down to earth, it was usable right from the start. Now, another feature that it didn't increase our joy of living was, I hope you can find some tape out of this, I hate these long pauses, was the individual criticism that you got, the analysis and criticism of every lesson. I don't know whether that applies to 50 years ago, more than now, or not. I could never see very much point in taking a raw student teacher and putting him in the class, then walking away and leaving. He's not going to learn too much that way. It sounds just dandy, but it doesn't work. He's got to know what he's trying to do. He's got to know what to expect of his pupils and so on. But these individual criticisms that we got, of course, as a result of a report from the presiding teacher, the regular teacher, then sometimes one of the staff of the normal school would be there as well. And by the time you're through with hashing over that lesson, you sometimes felt as if you were being dragged in by the cat or something.
You didn't have the same instructor come and criticize you each time. It was a different...
Well, it might be a different one, and it might not be very regular, because they couldn't get around. It was a student body of 230 or so people in that year, and that was quite a bit to cover. But we were all covered, I think, at least by one or two interviews and inspections who could come.
Did you find any one teacher was easier or harder on you than the other?
Yes. Now, the man that we feared most, and that he had most influence for or against us, would be McLaurin. There's where he gave you credit for everything that was good. And some of the dumbest darn things that I did, he would omit them, but point out that was good. He could find something good to say about it, and then he would analyze and say the bad things too. But you felt that he was not out there to get you. In fact, he was there to make you. And I'm forever grateful to McLaurin, particularly, because that, to a greater or lesser extent, was true of his whole staff. They were like that. They would find something good about you, even if you didn't know it was there yourself. And they would tell you what was wrong in no uncertain terms, but that's a fair deal. In fact, you'll never make any progress unless you do. In succeeding years, there was one who will be nameless, but his greatest boast was that he never gave any adverse criticism. He built on success. There's a cliche that gained a lot of ground unjustifiably. If you don't admit your mistakes, you're going to keep on making them, even if it's not the most popular thing to say at the time. Say, how are we doing?
Very well. I looked at your annual last night, your 24-25 annual, and I noticed that you were a musician. You were in the orchestra. That was the one year that they got their own orchestra together.
I wasn't playing the harp, as that book points out. Furthermore, they don't predict that that would happen to me ever, and it didn't.
How did this come about? You were all interested in something?
We had a chap there, his name was Bud Tweedale. I think his first name was Abbott. Abbott Tweedale, we called him Bud because that's the name he gave himself. And he was a very much better than average violinist. He came from Enderby, I'm pretty sure that was where he came from, to attend normal school. He brought his violin and a fist of music with him. He found a few other people who might be interested in an orchestra. Ordered up some music, I'm not sure where he got his funds, maybe out of his own pocket, I'm not sure. But we played through and performed quite a number of concerts. In fact, we provided the whole evening. Usually there were five. The pianist was a most gifted chap, Bernard Ryle, from Nanaimo, who could play anything on the piano at sight. He didn't need to even have seen music before to be able to play it accurately and faultlessly, just on sight. But that picture shows that same Bernard Ryle playing the fiddle to the tune of Putting It on a Sawhorse and sawing his way through it with a bucksaw. He did that to oblige the orchestra, because when we got another pianist and lost a violin, he came along and was able to fill in as a violinist as well, with practically nothing but the fact that he knew where the notes were. He could hit them. His playing was rough and ready, it's true, but so it was with myself and others. But Tweedale, the conductor, was smooth. He was good. And we had ourselves a practice about once a week. We put on either partial evenings or partial concerts, and on one or two occasions we put on a whole program, so that it was something that was a regular affair. It was a part of the training that, well, of course, I had been a self-taught violinist myself from the age of about 4. I had been given a violin, belonging to my father. My father was killed in an accident, and he was a good violinist. And, well, my mother said, you have to take over as violinist. Well, that I did, with horrible effects. But I was on that orchestra, and, of course, I had to memorize the parts because I couldn't read music at that time, but by golly, I soon learned, because it was a new experience for me, and it's an experience that I've never let slip.
Did you have a name for your group?
No. No, the orchestra got very little kudos is the word, I suppose, notoriety, fame, call it anything you like, compared to an athletic team, for instance. These are the ones that always shine in the public eye. It must be that athletics are more attractive to most people than music. But I got all the athletics I needed for and after a day's work at the normal school by going after a herd of cows and milking them, and then in the evening doing the same again. So that I did not lack athletic attainment as far as that goes. But I had no time for playing in, say, a rugby team.
Well,
I played little tennis, but not much in the way, because my time was taken up otherwise.
Yeah, I found that there were more musical students that year than any other year I've come across.
It might be that having one orchestra at a time, that that was enough, and they didn't want any more with us as a sample. But we did play things that I've enjoyed ever since. In fact, for the last 6 years, I've been playing in a concert orchestra myself now. And it's partly those first affections, those shadowy recollections, are yet the fountain light of all our being. That's where it started. And humble as the effort was, it began there.
There were morning assemblies. Do you remember the morning assemblies?
Did
you have to put on class plays or skits or talks?
Well, that part of it was Friday afternoon to us, but a very enjoyable part. We would take one lecture after the lunch hour, and then for the rest of the afternoon, perhaps a couple of hours, would be some kind of concert, usually put on, as you say, by a group, a class, and sometimes we mixed it up a bit to have men and women on the stage at the same time, because then there was one class of men, 36 men I think it was, and 4 or 5 classes of girls. I'm not sure this book would show it anyway. But we saw everything on that stage, and some of the students were older than others, you see, and one in particular had been a singer in England, and he had a workman's-like knowledge of opera. And we put on the odd opera. I shouldn't say we, because I didn't feature in that. I'm not an actor, and not a singer either, for that matter.
What did you do in the morning assemblies?
In the morning assemblies, were very formal. The staff filed in a methodical sequence and took the same seats every day. You knew exactly what they were going to do. The Lord's Prayer was sung, played, and it was to music composed, dedicated to D.L. McLaurin. It was a a musical interpretation of the Lord's Prayer that I had never heard any other place. And I've never heard it since, but the normal school every morning performed the Lord's Prayer as dedicated to Dr. D.L. McLaren. He wasn't doctor then, by the way, he was Mr. McLaren. And then each of the staff would take a turn at reading something of his own choice, or a recitation perhaps by one of the faculty, but usually it was something read, something of an elevating nature, or sometimes something very humorous and funny. Denton surprised them all by giving something religious, which was is the last place that you might have looked for something religious. Well, in other words, something to do with buying a packet of seeds. You toss the clerk a dime across the counter, and he tosses you the packet of seeds, and you walk out with a packet of divinity in your pocket. It was a very moving little poem. I don't know where he got it. Well, I couldn't pick out any one other, but they all took their turn. C.B. Wood, whose death was just announced not long ago, was a young member of the staff. He was the latest addition to their staff, apparently. He, too, had the same philosophy, that he could take your lesson, even if it was a bit of a dud, and just reshuffle it a bit so that it would be something from which you would improve your technique. But the morning assemblies, that's what you asked me, were, I think, I'm entitled to say they were inspiring. I think that. Because there was as much variety in what the staff did as there was a variety among the staff themselves. And there was a great variety among the staff. McLaren had his finger on the pulse of everything at all times and spent a great deal of his time actually teaching. I'm sure he taught individual classes easily as much as any of his staff. And his other...
What did he teach you? Do you remember?
In the individual staff level, he taught arithmetic. That's how to teach arithmetic. For instance, if you wanted to teach the area of a circle or something of that nature, he would give you exact things as to do. This is what you do. This, that, and the other thing. It was as definite as that. But out of that comes something which gives the student a little bit of confidence. What else did he teach besides the general purpose things? Well, to the whole auditorium and the whole assembly, he taught class management. That was the name for it then. It would be the general technique that underlies all teaching. And whether you're teaching geography or arithmetic, or I wouldn't say physical ed, because that is physical. But in teaching class management, he met up with most of the problems that beset teaching at all times and at all levels and in all places. That was one of his subjects, only one of them, too. To the assembly, he taught that, class management. Is there a name for it now? I'm sure that name has disappeared. You probably never heard of it. That's why I defined it.
I don't know what we call it
now. Classroom management? No, class management. That would be it. But if you, for the first few years of your teaching, if you kept a close watch on your class management notes, you would find the answer to an awful lot of what would be serious problems otherwise. So McLaren handled that. He handled the whole thing for the whole school.
I guess he taught you that most everybody was very young and going out to country schools, where some of your pupils would be almost as old as you.
That transpired in my own case as well as others. Yes, I had pupils. In fact, the inspector walked in and said, "Which is the teacher?" Because I had a boy there who was taller than I was. And I was the whole age of 18. And, I suppose our beginning teachers were younger than they are at the present time, because they weren't as, by and large, they weren't as well educated. I had no college at all at that level. And all the college I got has been by evening classes, summer classes, and so on ever since, but I've never been to college in the accepted sense of the word in my life.
You were just high school and then straight into normal school, right?
Yes, I took two high school graduations, one aimed at the university and one aimed at the normal school so that I could have been admitted to either. But that was all in the same year. I picked that up in the summertime, you see. And then it's been a matter of just summer courses. So, I mean, you couldn't in these early days of my teaching resign your job and go back to college for a year and then resume it. You couldn't do that. If you did resign your job, you were out, and when you came back the next year with an improved certificate, perhaps, but no job, and a whole battery of other students all ready to roll off the assembly line, too.
The year that you graduated from normal school, were jobs hard to come by?
I'd say they would be very scarce. It would make marvelous politics today to have a situation like that. Look at the unemployment. So many teachers graduated, 230 from Victoria, about twice that number from the Vancouver Normal School. And as far as we know, no available jobs. Because compulsory retirement wasn't in there, and the people who couldn't afford to retire would go to the age of 80 or so, still teaching. And some of them are very good, too, and some of them are awful because of their age. If I were forced to teach up to the age of 80, I would be as bad as any one of them, certainly, probably worse.
How did you find your job?
I wrote so many applications that I don't know myself how many it was, and never got an answer to a single one of them. So I thought, there's only one channel open. I'll go down to the Department of Education myself and see if there's anybody there who, to whom I can state my case at all, because my case was the same as nearly everybody else's had graduated. And the registrar of teachers asked me one question right abruptly at the beginning of our interview. I was put in contact with him. And he says, are you ready to go if a call comes in? And I said, yes, I am. I tell you right now, I'll take whatever job comes up, if I'm qualified to take it. That goes without saying. You wouldn't want any unqualified people. So it was only a couple of days later that the phone rang. It might have been that this registrar knew of such a place that was coming up. The term had already been going 3 weeks, but a school hadn't been able to open or get itself together by that time. So as soon as this call came in, I was ready to jump, and I went to Central British Columbia, and there I'll let my story end. But that's where I started in 1925, and about the 23rd or 22nd of September was by that time.
Was the man that you saw, Mr. Watson, down?
Yes. Yes, it was. And he was most helpful, too, for that matter. But there was one thing that the department, and it was department policy, didn't help me at all. I explained to him that this is to be a new school. That's what he had already told me that. Never been one there before, and it was in a mining camp. I said, could I please make out a list of books that I'm sure to need right away? And he said, no, you've got to go up there and see how many pupils you've got and fill in the right forms and send them down. So when I did start off, of course this is getting away from normal school now, but when I did start off, the pupils had no textbooks. There were two grocery stores in the camp, but none of them sold stationery which is suitable for use in school. So there was a bit of a tangle there, but we started out somehow, and when you're young, and then, of course, I don't need to tell you this, you'll try anything because you don't know what you can do and what you can't. So you try everything. And it was a very, very happy year.
Well, at the normal school, in your classes, you had to prepare everything yourself. Did you find that helpful when you took it out? You had something to use?
Again, if it demands resourcefulness on the part of the teacher, anything is good. It can be turned to good, not a good thing in itself. I don't recommend cheating the teachers out of the use of their textbooks or any other books or supplies for that matter. But if they can get in there and make a fist out of it somehow, they get all kinds of help from the most unexpected directions. But you've got to show that your own effort is in the right place.
When you were at the normal school, did you ever have a home economics class, domestic science, learn the basics, how to fend for yourself?
I think the girls took something like that, but there, I can't answer you there because I don't recall that there was anything to do with home economics for men.
Yeah. Some years the men did take a basic cooking course, and other years they didn't. I was wondering if you were...
I see. Well, that covers, of course, a long period of time, but I wouldn't say there wasn't. I don't know what the girls did when the boys got together for physical training. There might have been domestic science classes or something. I couldn't say. Too long ago, or maybe I didn't even know at the time.
You didn't have any classes with the women, did you?
Excepting these assemblies, such as class management. Well, I've been very unmethodical about this whole thing.
Well, there's one other question. In your year, did you have the little vegetable gardens that everybody had to tend to?
No.
No? Some years they had little garden plots that everybody had to tend to.
I think that was an offshoot of World War I. I was in elementary school myself as a pupil. And during that time, during and after World War I, schools did have little plots and gardens. And, well, it was more to keep their morale up in wartime than anything else. I doubt that there was very much value in what we did, excepting that we had the experience. City children, for instance, would have had no experience of gardening at all. But I was out in the country here with my dairy farm, as you can understand, and any little extra agriculture which arose from the school was a little bit superfluous to establishment.
Did you have any contact at all with the gardeners or the janitor? Some people had mentioned that the janitor seemed almost like a father figure to some of them because he was someone they could talk to. They didn't look up to him like the teachers. They were scared.
I've known a good many janitors in several schools in succeeding years to whom that could apply. I don't recall particularly any janitors at the normal school. Though, mind you, it might have been that they were most notable people, and I've simply forgotten all about them by this time. But it would be true of a good many schools that I've been in since, that the janitor held almost a unique position. Ombudsman, you might have called it. Not exactly self-appointed, but appointed by the pupils, you know, the kind of guy that you can talk to. At the high school, for instance, if you lost your locker keys and you couldn't find a prefect, there was a janitor there who could always oblige you and would keep his mouth shut about it.
Were the rose gardens down in the front of the building when you were there, by the tennis courts?
I remember playing tennis on the tennis courts the few times that I had a chance to play any games. But I don't remember any gardening work going on outdoors. In succeeding years, of course, the thing kept on changing, and once in a while I would visit for this or that reason. And I would notice that the gardening had been changed, or the tennis courts had been, I think they've disappeared, have they not? Mm-hmm. From the front of the...
They've gone now.
Of the old normal school itself. These tennis courts are gone. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lunchroom when you were there? Was there a lunchroom where you could eat?
I don't think so. I'm not sure where. Of course, we eat our lunches outside as often as possible, but if it was a matter of eating indoors, I can't recall just what we did by way of lunches. Perhaps every individual went to his own classroom, his own home classroom. I simply couldn't say it. I don't remember. See, I've been retired 10 years, as well as teaching 43. Retired. This is my 11th year in retirement, so I don't know just how much of this is accurate or not.
Do any of the other instructors stand out in your mind?
To say stand out would be to say that some were better than others. They must have been. I was particularly impressed by Freeman. Mr. Freeman was a man of he was getting up in years, let's say. He was calm, never in the accusative case. He didn't make people's lives miserable at any time, even if he could have. But he was a good teacher. He gave it again, just like all the others, he gave us something that we could really start off with. And it was one of the most difficult of all subjects, pedagogically speaking. After McLaurin, say Freeman. And it was more because of his kindly attitude and against the backdrop of very, very rigid control. There was no doubt about it. McLaurin was like an army general. That's how we think of army generals. I don't know any personally, so.
Mr. Freeman would be his opposite, wouldn't he?
He would be just a good mix-in with that. Just as McLaurin was an ultra-conservative in many ways, at least that's the image he projected. Denton, a man's man, certainly more a man of the world than McLaurin. It was a good balance all the way through, and whether it was done accidentally or on purpose, I would never know. But again, Freeman had, I think, a rather deep religious faith. I've gathered that more from drinking it in through the skin than from anything that he specifically said. But I think that would turn out to be so. The youngest man on the staff was Wood. The youngest person on the staff was Wood, and he was a young and experienced too. But he had that same dedication about him, that same sense of fairness that really made him outstanding in a way, excepting I couldn't exactly by definition say that all the staff were outstanding, but that's about the way I felt about them then. And certainly all the more so since, in the view of a lot of experience.
There were model schools up there. Did you ever get a chance to teach in them, or did you just observe?
Some of the students taught in them. I didn't, personally. And I never observed in them either, for that matter, in the model school. But on one occasion, I don't suppose it was a whole class of elementary school pupils, but a group of them were brought in, and some of our own students would teach object lessons to them. I remember Tommy Horn, for instance. I don't know if you know that name or not. But Tommy Horn acted as their teacher, and the whole thing was set up on the stage, and the rest of us filled the auditorium and watched him teach them something. I'm not sure what. And, yes, there was that kind of effort being made. I never taught in the model school myself.
Did you find that the library at the normal school was very helpful? I remember it was quite a small library, as I understand.
I remember the little place. It was small enough. And the use I made of it most was scanning and sometimes reading books as outlined by McLaurin in his class management. I can't say that I used it as a source of reference material for teaching because it just didn't seem to have enough of that. Of course, there were 230 pupils, all students, all trying to make use of that same stuff. So that, no, as far as an aid to background and so on for teaching, I don't think that there was very much to it. Maybe I'm unfair to them. Maybe I didn't make use of what was there in the way that I should. But that was my impression anyway.
Was Miss Riddell your music teacher then? Miss Riddell, was she the music instructor?
Yes. Yes, Miss Riddell handled all primary teaching, of course. It's a thing that was not, men were not eligible to teach in primary grades in these years. But we did, because as McLaurin pointed out, you're going to be principals perhaps, and you should have some knowledge of what goes on in a primary school. So we took the same lectures from Miss Riddell, I suppose, as she gave to all the girl teachers. And she taught music to all of the classes. And she was a whiz at teaching the music. I wasn't able to assess her teaching and her advice on other subjects in the primary grades.
Did you have to audition for her to find what kind of voice you had?
Yes. Oh, yes, and she taught even the most unmusical people to read off the modulator, the tonic sol fas. As a result of which, I had an experience that I didn't really appreciate at the time, but, well, I've always tinkered away at music, as you can imagine myself, but I was supposed to teach singing to a grade 5 in the Boys Central School. And I unrolled this tonic sol fa business and pointed out individual notes, and they would sing do, mi, re, dum, 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 according to that. And I said, I know, let's this half of the classroom watch just this hand, this pointer. I'll have another ruler in this hand and put on two. Ready? Go. And we played and sang part songs in harmony, and that class was able to follow what I was doing when I was giving them two parts at once. All that I did was, it was as simple as playing a two-note harmony on the piano. Well, there was nothing to that at all. Well, here we had it here. The pupils had no experience at it. The teacher thought it was a marvelous performance on my part, and I did nothing to try and disillusion her either. But the part that was marvelous was the pupils themselves. They must have been awfully well taught, because I've never had a class since that could do that. I've had a grade 8 later, and it was unique in its way that I could take a two-part song, but one part at a time, and this class will be this, and they could follow a tune that was unfamiliar to them. And then the other half, say, this Waltz, Beautiful Ohio, for instance, well, the girls would be singing the treble part, and the boys would be singing the descant. And after a whirl through each, then, in the space of about 5 minutes, they were singing a part song, a harmony, a waltz in harmony. But apart from that, I've never had a class that, or never found a class in my school, because I taught a lot of music even when I was principal. But I've never found a class that could follow a two-part harmony on a piece of music that was unfamiliar to them. So this teacher in charge of the class gave me a marvelous criticism for something, and she gave credit where it was not due at all, but I hope she never discovered her mistake.
Did you have any social life at the normal school? You played in the orchestra at their gatherings.
That's where maybe my only criticism so far has been of the attitude of fellow students. It wasn't their fault, but it was the mores of the day. I wasn't much of a part of what was going on. I wasn't able to avail myself of any class parties or something, because I was 10 miles out of town on a dairy farm, and they were 10 miles away in the city. And in these days, students were not tolerant of other students who had jobs or worked, or who couldn't afford that manual, or build up on that, if you like. So that I can't say much about the social life of the school, because I was no part of it.
There must have been groups of friends then within the normal school, were there?
I would judge so, but remember, they came from all over the province. The Vancouver Normal School took in mostly Vancouver people, but these people from Victoria, at the normal school, and in Victoria, they were from, well, Bud Abbott, the violinist, was from Enderby, northern Okanagan. Bernard Ryle, the pianist, was from Nanaimo. So these people had never met before, and it's pretty hard to say. I got on very well with one of the older men. He was a war veteran, World War I, in the Royal Flying Corps. He came up to Canada, as so many did after the war. And his name was P.C. Runkley. Got along very well with him. And because of my experience outside of schools entirely, I suppose it could be said I got along much better with older men than with boys, teenage boys of my own age. But teenagers are, by nature, I hope you're not too far removed from the teens yourself, but their views are pretty definite. For instance, if a boy is supposed to wear long hair and doesn't do it, well, he's a square. it could be even socially ostracized. So that I don't think that pupil or student prejudice has changed very much. But today, the prevailing thought is that if a boy, or a girl either for that matter, can hold down a job, even get married, and carry on with professional training too, so much the better. We live in a much more tolerant age today, although even then, as I say, concerning the long hair, the short, and the like of it.
The normal school really did prepare you well, didn't it, for your teaching?
Yes. Unqualified yes.